Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Peter Heller is a writer of literary nonfiction and novels, including his bestseller, The Dog Stars. His latest novel, The River, is a thriller that draws from some of Peter's own experiences canoeing wild rivers. Peter Heller talks this hour with fellow author Peter Robertson. He asked Heller to start off by reading from The River.
Peter asked what I'd want to read, and you throw a dart anywhere in this book and you hit a spoiler. So I didn't want to do that, and I thought if I just started from the beginning, I'd save you guys a little time. So I will, and I'm just going to read the first page and a half, the prologue. They had been smelling smoke for 2 days. At first, they thought it was another campfire, and that surprised them because they had not heard the engine of a plane, and they'd been traveling the string of long lakes for days and had not seen sign of another person or even the distant movement of another canoe. The only tracks in the mud of the portages were wolf and moose, otter, bear. The winds were west and north, and they were moving north, so if it was another party, they were ahead of them. It perplexed them because they were smelling smoke, not only in early morning and at night, but would catch themselves at odd hours, lifting their noses like coyotes, nostrils flaring. And then one evening they pulled up on a wooded island and they made camp and fried a meal of lake trout on a driftwood fire and watched the sun sink into the spruce on the far shore. Late August, a clear night becoming cold. There was no aurora borealis, just the dense sparks of the stars blown from their own ancient fire. They climbed a hill. They did not need a headlamp as they were used to moving in the dark. Sometimes, if they were feeling strong, they paddled half the night. They loved how the darkness amplified the sounds, the gulp of the dipping paddles, the knock of the wood shaft against the gunwale, the long, desolate cry of a loon. The loons especially, how they hollowed out the night with longing. Tonight there was no loon and almost no wind, and they went up through tamarack and hemlock and a few large birch trees whose pale bark fluoresced. At the top of the knoll, they followed a game trail to a ledge of broken rocks, as if they weren't the first who had sought the view. And they saw it. They looked northwest. At first, they thought it was the sun, but it was far too late for any lingering sunset, and there were no cities in that direction for 1,000 miles. In the farthest distance, over the trees, was an orange glow. It lay on the horizon like the light from banked embers, and it fluttered barely, so they wondered if it was their eyes, and they knew it was a fire. A forest fire. Who knew how far off or how big, but bigger than any they could imagine. It seemed to spread over 2 quadrants, and they didn't say a word, but the silence of it and the way it seemed to breathe scared them to the bone. The prevailing wind would push the blaze right to them. At the pace they were going, they were at least 2 weeks from the Cree village of Wapak and Hudson Bay. When the most northerly lakes spilled into the river, they would pick up speed, but there was no way to shorten the miles. Thank you. I always like to say, just because it's fun to say.
Please tell us something about your kayaking history. I know that your first major magazine assignment was as a kayaker. What had you done prior to that?
Tell them quickly what the book's about or not?
They've spoken, yes.
Oh, okay. I forgot to do that. I'm sorry, Peter. So it's 2 young guys. They're best friends in college. They met on the first day. Jack is a ranch kid from western Colorado. He spent half his life in the saddle, sleeping out under the stars and making breakfast over an open fire, like second nature to Jack. He's tough, you know, the way those kids are tough. Rain, wet, cold, hunger, they're not good or bad, they're just, you know, they just are. And if you get through them, that's all right. And he has suffered a tragedy when he was like 11. I won't tell you what it is, but it was really about as bad as it can get. and it made him retreat from the world a little bit into books and fishing and working with his dad on the ranch. He's a voracious reader, and he's sort of wary of the world. Wynn, on the other hand, is a gentle giant. He's like 6'5". He stoops protectively over people, and he loves to make ephemeral art out of sticks and rocks and feathers, a la Goldsworthy. And he's an architect's son from Vermont, and he's sort of like a black lab. That's how Jack thinks of him, because he expects the best of everybody. I mean, it's the tail's wagging all the time, until proven otherwise, and even then. And so they're both consummate outdoorsmen, and they bonded right away. They love books. They'd never met another kid, an outdoorsman, who just loved books so much. And they decide to guide in the summer, and then blow half their guide money on a plane into this lake. It's a string of five lakes that flow north, and then the river flows out of the most northern lake and up into Hudson Bay, about 250 miles, and they're going to take a month. They don't take watches. They don't take a sat phone. They just want to just immerse themselves in the rhythm of the landscape, and they'll call the plane once they get to the Cree village. But stuff doesn't quite go as planned. At all.
Peter, I think you've told them enough. They still have to buy the book.
Cool. Okay. All right. Now we can go. Sorry.
I wanted to go back a ways to your first assignment,
yep.
Which was as a kayaker, and I believe it was to some place frightening. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, so, you know, I grew up wanting to be a poet and a fiction writer, and I got out of college and I had to make a living, and I was doing all sorts of stuff. I was living in Boulder, and I was delivering pizza, and I was really good at it because stop signs meant nothing. And and I was kayaking as much as I could. I was teaching kayaking some, and a friend of mine said, you know, why don't you combine your interests? You spend all day writing poetry, and you know, you're kayaking this crazy stuff. Why don't you write for Outside? Being young and dumb, I just went to the magazine store and I picked up an Outside magazine. I looked for the name of an editor who sounded nice. I sort of passed up Felix somebody, and I picked Laura Honhold. Doesn't that sound nice? And I called the 800 number for Outside, and they said, Outside magazine. I said, Laura Honhold, please. She said, just a minute. And then, Laura here. And I was like, oh, crap. And I started talking as fast as I could. And I said, hey, I live in Colorado. I'm a class 5 kayaker. And I had a...
What is a class 5 kayaker?
It's just scary. It's big waves, you know, and big hydraulics. And if you screw up at all, you're probably not going to be happy. So... And I said, I think you, and I said, I had a story published in Harper's, which was sort of true. And it was in the reading section. It was about this long. It was a reprint of a college story. And so it was in there. And I said, I think you guys should send me on an expedition to the edge of the Tibetan Plateau to run this river that's never been run. And there was this incredulous sort of silence. I could sort of hear WTF in the background. And then she said, you know, we've heard about this expedition, and we don't have a writer that can kayak class 5, and I'm going to take a chance on you, and I'm going to pay half your expenses, and if you write a good story, I'll pay the other half, and I'll buy the story. And I thought, yes, because my paddle was all duct taped together. I needed a new paddle. And so anyway, I realized later that she sent me because I was totally expendable. In any event, I went, and on the first day, I won't tell the whole story, but the first day of the expedition, I was one of the three kayakers, and the rest was rafters, and one of the rafts flipped, and a guy washed into a log jam, and the other kayaker and I hauled one guy out of it, and we couldn't budge the second guy, and he was on his honeymoon. And the river was rising, and we tried a Z-drag, and you know, a lot of leverage, and we held him, and the river rose, and it rose over his head, and... he died in our arms, and first day, and we had to paddle across the river and tell his wife. And it was a rugged way to start in journalism. That's the story.
Have you canoed this particular stretch of water yourself? And this is kind of a two-part question. If you have, would you consider it to be an appropriate date?
These Scotsmen, they're so romantic. I really do think that. No.
However.
I got an assignment. All right, I know what you're getting at. I got an assignment to run a river a few years ago called the Winisk, W-I-N-I-S-K, which is, it is the Moskwa River, as described. And I was on a third date with this woman that I liked, and she wanted to drop her gym bag off at my house before we went to dinner. And I picked it up, and it was really heavy. And I said, what's in here? And she said, weaponry. And she unzipped it, and inside were short swords and throwing stars and sharpened chopsticks. And I was like, damn, this woman is lethal. And as she'd never been camping, I asked her, or in a canoe. But during dinner, I really liked her, and I thought, you know, she could protect me, you know, from bears and stuff. And so I asked her to come on the river, and she'd never been in a canoe, and this is really remote, and it's whitewater, and it's, you know, it's challenging. It's like 3 weeks. So we were packing up the canoe, and we had these blue plastic waterproof barrels for provisions, and we were packing them up, and she said, can I bring my eyebrow tweezers? And I was so shocked. I mean, no one had ever asked me that before. And
who knew they were weapons?
Yeah, I mean, they obviously were sharpened. But I should have been more gracious. I mean, how much do they weigh, right? Like an ounce. And I said, no. And she got me back because as we went down the river, it turns out she loves fossils. And she started to load up the canoe with rocks. And we started to lose our freeboard. We're getting lower and lower in the water, and we're running whitewater. And one morning, you know, I was loading up the canoe, and I went to the boat, and there was a 12-pound chunk of limestone with a tiny little clam fossil in one corner of it. And I could barely pick it up, and I picked it up, and I said, Kim, you know, do you think? She looked at me with, like, ninja eyes, and she said, don't minimize me. And that's when I knew, she was someone to ride the river with because you kind of know what you need. And now we're married. And I sort of do whatever she says.
Are the two of you still doing adventurous things together?
Yeah, we surf together, which is really cool. We learned to surf. There's a book called Kook I wrote about that. But she's really tough. Like, she came up as a model and an actor. And, you know, she's a girly girl, but she loves, you know, martial arts and stuff, and she says, I'm always on four-wheel drive with you, and she still comes, and she gets every time she gets a mosquito or a black fly bite, she swells up, and she still comes on all these things. So
there was a line towards the beginning of the book, it's on page 44, and it says, a great storyteller has to know when never to lie. Please explain that to me.
I think that's referring to, so Jack's uncle Lloyd shares the ranch next, he runs the ranch next door, and Jack loves his uncle, and his uncle's a good rancher, and the two brothers help each other. And one thing he loves about Lloyd is that he's an extraordinary storyteller, and he wouldn't let the truth get in the way of a good story, and he's a wonderful elaborator. But Jack says he never stretches when he's talking about hunting or fishing. The fish never get bigger. There's never more points on the rack. And Uncle Lloyd says, you know, hunting and fishing are so darn fun, you know, you'd have to be a jerk to lie about them. And I think Jack really respects that. And I sort of think, you know, what he's talking about is there's just some, when you're a great storyteller, there's just some things that you want to hew actually to the facts and tell the truth. But there's a lot of ways to tell the truth, I guess.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Peter Heller talks about how Hemingway's Nick Adams stories inspired him to become a writer and an adventurer.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Peter Robertson's conversation with Peter Heller.
You mentioned that the two young gentlemen are very different. I wanted to know how much of yourself ended up being in each one of them.
So Wynn is a real guy. Wynn is my friend Jay Mead, and I mentioned him in the book. Jay Mead is he's an ephemeral artist in Vermont. He makes these beautiful sculptures, like he'll make moons out of saplings that climb up a hill, and then the saplings get fungus and mushrooms on them, and they degrade, and the moons change, and they're really beautiful. And there's a story in the book about the two boys meeting on the orientation trip, and they're so excited about talking about books and art and fishing and mountains and canoes that they outstrip their group by miles, and then they think, well, let's just make a fire, make a cup of tea, and wait. And so when the rest of the group comes, these guys are sprawled out drinking tea, and they get a reputation. And that story is true, and that happened with Jay Mead and myself. And Jay is, you know, he's 6'5", he's so gentle, and he's a great pond hockey player and a great skier and just a great outdoorsman, super tough, but really gentle at the same time. And he expects the best of everybody. And I guess that makes me sort of like Jack. I mean, Jack is 100 times tougher than I am, but I share the same sort of wariness of people that Jack does, I think. And that may have to do with growing up in New York City.
I did notice that Wynn's middle name was Peter, and I've noticed that there are quite a few Peters in your books, or Pete's, or Pierre. It occurred to me, first of all, it's an excellent name. but I did wonder why there are so many of them.
That's really embarrassing. Wow, man. Well, I'll let you know after. I have no idea. But it is, you know, it is fun to put people's name that you know in the book. I do that a lot with my fiction. There's, you know, if you read The Painter, there's a Willie Kessler in there, and he's my neighbor in Paonia, Willie Kessler. And there's a Bob, I think there's a Bob Reed in The Painter. He runs the gas station, and there's a guy named Bobby Reedy, who's a very dear friend, who runs the gas station. And so I try not, I do that just so that they'll have fun reading it, but sometimes it gets dicey.
You've written with younger characters in previous books, but this is the first time the two young college kids are the center of the story. Was this harder for you to write?
Because they're young?
Yes.
I sort of remember that part. I know, it's weird. I mean, all I do now is drink coffee and eat Advil. But it wasn't hard because that was such a great time of our lives. You remember being, you know, 21 and going out and having adventures. And those sort of adventures, I think, for me, they sort of live, they live inside me almost on a cellular level. If I close my eyes, I can, you know, sort of, I can still feel the current of certain rivers and still remember, you know, the sound of a can of kippered herring opening. You remember? And you're by a river and you remember that sound? And eating that really hungrily with a best friend on a river when you're out for a few days. And all those things sort of live in my body. And it's so much fun about writing fiction for me is that I get to relive those experiences and sort of re-synthesize them or digest them. And it's almost like living in a double feature. You know, you get to live it all again when you're writing the fiction, but have it the way you want it to go. Or not, you know, which is interesting.
To me, the two young boys seemed both legitimately modern and almost romantic and slightly old, anachronistic. Was that your intention?
I think I'm slightly anachronistic. So, no, I get it. I mean, not very many people these days are writing about, you know, long canoe trips.
Well, they're writing young adult fiction, which would have characters that age, but they'd be slackers who would not go canoeing anywhere.
Right. Man, the world is so screwed up. It's what you say when you're an old guy, you know? It's like, dad's kids these days. Yeah, it is interesting. But I grew up reading Hemingway. And, you know, I have to say, you know, there's the first book that made me want to write fiction was about Michigan. I was in my little library in Brooklyn Heights when I was 11. And the librarian's name was Annie Bosworth. So Annie Bosworth, she was English, and I had a crush on her, a big crush. And I would have married her that day for the way she said my name. And she said, Peter, are you looking for something? I won't even try. Are you looking for something to read? Uh-huh, thump, thump, thump. And she said, well, come over here. So a great librarian, like a great bookseller, who's been following your reading since you were five, which she had, knows what you're ready for. And she took me to the fiction shelf, and she pulled out the slim volume called In Our Time by Ernest Hemingway. And it's mostly Nick Adams stories up in Michigan. And you've got to picture an 11-year-old kid in Brooklyn taking that home and cracking it open. And my heart, like, leapt out of my chest. I thought, you know, I want to do that. I want to hop off a slow-moving freight train with a rucksack and walk through grass that wets my pant legs with dew and make camp by the big two-hearted river. And I want to make cowboy coffee. And I didn't know what that was, but it sounded awesome. And I want to not burn my tongue the way Nick didn't burn his tongue. And I want to fish for those beautiful, gorgeous trout the way he did. But mostly, and then like in the end of something, remember that beautiful breakup story? I wanted to have a girlfriend that could row and fish like a man, like she did. And then I wanted to break up with her because Nick did. And I still don't know why he broke up with her. And I think I sort of concluded later it's because she was much better than he was. But mostly what I wanted was to write like this guy, because the prose, it was my first experience of reading fiction and having the prose go right through my skin. You know that feeling when you just love writing so much and it goes right to your heart and sort of bypasses the head? And I had that experience and was like, I want to do that. So thank you, Michigan and Ernest and all that. Yeah.
There's a section about halfway through the book, and it's a packing list. It's where the two boys decide what they're going to take. I think that functions in several different ways, and I'm hoping that you will come to the same conclusion.
Yes, Professor. I hate it when there's a right answer. The packing list. I got an email the other day. You know, I really liked your book, but, you know, you start listing gear and it really makes me sleepy. No, it didn't make you sleep. You're very kind.
Very quickly, this is what I think of the packing list.
Okay.
For a certain reader, and I'm going to say probably a male reader, it's gun camping geek porn.
Thanks.
You're welcome. But I also think it's a marshalling of thoughts and it's a compartmentalizing of fears and strategies that the two young men are putting together for what they imagine is going to be the worst part. For the reader, I found it to be a calming sort of deep breath before I knew things were going to turn quite unpleasant.
Can I take you back to Denver? That is awesome.
I'll be there in 3 weeks.
That's great. Well, come over. That is really cool. Thing about being a novelist is that I start with the first line because I go by the sound of the language, and I don't plot because I did a lot of nonfiction, you know, magazine articles. I always knew what the ending was going to be and what was going to happen next. So when I came to fiction, I didn't want to know. I wanted it to be more like a river trip of a river that you've never been on. So when I'm writing, I don't really mean to do anything. I just sort of follow my nose and I follow the language. And the story rides the back of the language. And so I don't have a whole lot of intention about what I'm doing, which English professors hate to hear. So when I hear something like that, I think, wow, that's really cool. And, you know, I didn't mean to, but But when you go to France, I've been on book tour in France, and they're so great because they're so intellectual in France. I mean, they love their literature, and they ask these questions about, you know, they say, you know, in the Dog Stars, you know, there's this motif of, you know, the ode on a Grecian urn and the ephemeralness of, they go on, and they say, you know, how did you structure that? And I just look at them, and I don't want to disappoint them.
As you told me earlier today, you try not to suck.
Exactly. That's the main goal. But they're so funny. I just have to tell this one story about France because it's so fun. When I was over there last time, they wanted to take my photograph in the courtyard of Arc de Sud, which is sort of like the Canop of France. And they had a photographer come out, and I was like dressed like this, and the photographer. And there was a tree. So he was on his tripod, and I leaned against the tree, and I smiled like any author would. And he said, "Oh, Peter, no. No, listen, you must show that you suffer." And I looked at him. I said, "Jean-Claude, I'm really having fun." But the French have this whole mythos of the right of the author, you know, that you suffer a lot and you wait for inspiration, and meanwhile you drink too much and your marriage goes to hell, and but you eventually you get struck by lightning, I guess.
Is there a relationship between the amount of adventure that your reader has personally experienced and the amount of pleasure they're going to get from your fiction?
I hope not. Because no, that's a really good question. But I think I want people to read these books who have never, you know, someone in the city who has never, you know, even thought about sleeping out under the stars. I want them to love the books too. And it seems like some of those people do. So, you know, knock wood that there's not a relationship that way.
Without giving away the ending, would it be fair to say that someone gets away with murder?
How am I supposed to answer that?
I ask this because we were speaking today at lunch, and I mentioned that I thought that three of your books kind of fall together in certain ways. And one of the ways that I think they fall together is that they all demonstrate a particular type of justice. And I wouldn't call it conventional justice, but I think it's a justice of its own. And I wondered if you could elaborate on that for me, or tell me that that's utter nonsense and I should say something else.
I do believe in karma, that's for sure. And I'm very interested in good people that run into complications and maybe do bad things and then try and be good again. Because I think that's the story of all of our lives. We're always constantly trying to redeem ourselves because we always screw up. And I'm interested in that. I mean, I don't think there's anything really more interesting. It's where grace comes in. I mean, there wouldn't be a touch of grace if we didn't fall. If we were all perfect and angelic, then there would be no such thing as grace. And I'm really interested in grace.
Going back to my packing list, because I'm not prepared to give that one up. This is, do you get the occasional, how shall I put this, smartass telling you that your characters are using the wrong gun or the wrong fly or the wrong something? And I say that knowing that that person is going to be inevitably a male. And how do you deal with it?
Oh, it's so great. I was at an open house, at an open sort of 2-hour deal in a little bookstore in Monument, Colorado, north of Colorado Springs last year. And a guy came to the table, and it was sort of meet the author and sit down and chat. And the guy came to the table, and he kind of had a hard time looking up at me, and a little mustache. And he said, finally said, "I love guns." And he sort of scared me. But we started talking about guns, and it was pretty clear that, you know, I only knew about hunting rifles, and he left extremely disappointed because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of high-powered weaponry in the Dog Stars, and I don't know much about it. I just put it in the book. So he was disappointed, that guy. But it's interesting, when you write about, I've written about flying now, small planes, and I've written about fly fishing, and those are two activities that are taken up by some of the most assiduous, that's probably the nice word, people on the planet. I mean, fly fishermen and women and pilots, you know, are incredibly detail-oriented because you have to be, right? And might be a little obsessive about the details. And it's one of the, you know, it's sort of the reason I love to fly, and I love to fly fish, because there's so much technical stuff that you want to get under control, and then you just sort of have to lose your, you know, you get that under your belt a little bit, and then you can lose yourself in the activity. And, you know, I got one letter after the Dog Stars came out from a pilot who said, I spelled the name of the aviation oil that they use in the engine oil, I spelled it wrong. It was Aeroshell.
That was a guy who wrote that letter, correct?
Yeah, it was a guy who wrote the letter, but I was like so psyched that it, you know, that it was, that was the only letter that I got, you know, taking the, being so brave about, you know, wading into those activities. And when I finished the river, and this is really cool, I have been in a big fire that almost overtook us, and the trees exploding and all that. And I remember,
do they make that much noise?
They make a lot of noise. Yeah. Oh yeah, and they scream like, you know, that when the boiling sap, you know, is pushed through the cells of the tree, it makes this terrible shriek, if you've ever heard it. And when I finished the book, I sent it to a friend who has spent a lot of time up in the Arctic, and I didn't know this about him, but he said, you know, the fire scene in here just gave me the willies, and it was so real. And he had been a hotshot when he was a kid. And it said it just brought back, you know, that whole experience. And that just made me so happy that someone who was, you know, so, you know, immersed in that world and was an expert, you know, was convincing for them. And that's always nice when you're writing fiction.
Do men and women read differently? I ask that because I listened to your previous trip here 2 years ago when you were here with Celine. And at the end, there were two questions asked, and a woman stood up and asked you about poetry, and if you were familiar with a particular poet, who not only were you familiar with, but you also then quoted that poet, and you clearly made that woman's night. 2 seconds later, or 2 seconds before, a gentleman stood up and asked you if you were familiar with a certain fly that's native to Michigan, and you were. And I thought, these are people who clearly read in very different ways. Do your books cover both ground, or do you have more female readers, more male readers?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Knopf, who's my publisher, they say that most readers of literary fiction are women. And I didn't know that because when I go to readings, half the audience are men. And, you know, Knopf has been really getting a kick out of, you know, having an author whose, you know, readership is half men. And I'm so honored by that. I think that's neat. And I love getting letters, emails and stuff from men and women and young people and old people. So I certainly don't try and write towards. I wrote a book that came out in September. It's on Scribd, which is a little subscription service. It's an audio book thing. And it's called The Orchard, and it's all women. It's from the point of view of an 8-year-old girl. And she and her mom moved to a defunct orchard in Vermont. And it's about the two of them. The mother is a translator of Tang Dynasty poetry, and there's a lot of the poetry in the book. It's a very quiet book, but it's about the little girl and her mom and their friend Rosie and their dog Bear. And that's what it's about. And it's not, you wouldn't think, a man's book, but there you go.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Peter Robertson talking with author Peter Heller, whose latest novel is The River.
Thank you.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Peter Robertson's conversation with Peter Heller.
In your last visit, you mentioned that the river began in a different way as a memory of something someone told you.
Yeah, so when you write, you know, from a first line, the way I do, and you don't plot much, you sort of go along with the language, and then pretty soon you bump into what's really on your mind or on your heart. And I started with the line, you know, they've been smelling smoke for 2 days. That's the first line of the river. And, you know, here they are, these two guys are on a lake, and they see a fire. And pretty soon I bumped into a story that happened to me when I was 17. And what happened was I was in love for the first time. I was in a little boarding school in Vermont, southern Vermont.
Did she have a British accent?
No. But she didn't have a thick New Hampshire accent either. But yeah, she did a little bit. And she lived across the river in New Hampshire. And her mom had a little cedar shingled farmhouse on the edge of the White Mountains in a place called Chikarawa. And there was a meadow and horses and a lake at the bottom of it. And across the lake was a rock top mountain, little Monadnock of a mountain. And it was so beautiful, and I just thought it was the greatest thing. And Margaret had three older sisters, all of whom I thought were attractive, and a single mom who was also attractive. And on the weekend, all the suitors would come out of the hills like a fairy tale and descend on this little house, and they'd have these big spaghetti dinners. Everybody was broke. It was all musicians and students, and you know, somebody would drive up from Boston, an old Saab with a roof all taped together. Remember those? And all sort of like charmingly unaware that this was like the best year of their lives. And we'd have these parties in this. And I remember one October night, the house was crammed full of people, and I had my cheap beer, and I was 17, and the Statue of Limitations is over now, somebody said, and there was a guy leaning against the wall, and he was like really handsome and charismatic, and he looked really sad, and he was one of those sad charismatic guys, and somebody said, hey Pete, you know, you ought to go talk to him because he makes his living in a canoe, and he's a geochemist and he studies watersheds, and you ought to go talk to him. So my ears kind of swiveled because that's what I wanted to do. And so I walked over and I clinked my beer bottle because I thought that's what you're supposed to do. And I said, hey, you look a little rough. What's up? And he said, I lost my wife 2 months ago. And he was like in his late 20s. And I was so flabbergasted. And I said, well, what happened? And he said, we were on a canoe trip doing a study way up in Labrador, super remote. And we were a couple weeks out, and we were camped, and she left the breakfast fire and went over the berm to relieve herself, and I never saw her again. I was like, whoa, was there a bear sign? And he said, no bear sign. I said, well, did you look for her? And he's, is that funny? And he said, yeah, of course. I mean, I looked a couple of days. And I walked away from that conversation, and I knew he was lying. My antennae were humming, and I was only 17, but I was dead certain this guy, and I thought, that son of a bitch killed his wife. And I must have been thinking about it for the last 40 years. Anyway, that sort of is the story that I bumped into when I started on the river.
Peter, we're going to move back to some of the other books now. So it occurs to me that perhaps, did you want to do the second reading now?
Sure.
And would you read the half page that I demanded that you read?
Of course, Peter.
Thank you.
Anybody who feels that way about my packing list, I'll read whatever you want. Thank you. So they paddled to the northern end of the most northerly of the five lakes, and this is where the river begins. Now, as they zipped their life jackets and slid the canoe into the water and hopped in, as they paddled for the middle of the cove, which narrowed toward the north and began to show current and funneled into a wide V that picked up speed and slipped down between banks of spruce, And as they looked ahead and saw the horizon line of the first rapid and dug in and paddled hard for the right bank, as they truly began to run the river, they didn't think about anything but making it into the wide eddy pool along the right shore so they could scout the falls. But every river story they'd ever read was just beneath the surface of their imagination and must have fired them with extra energy and braced them too, because at least half of those stories did not have happy endings.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask questions about the books in the order which I read them, which was I read Celine first just before I came here. There were two questions that were raised last time that I wanted to see what the progress was from that point. One was, would you consider writing more about Celine?
Certainly. I just never know who's going to start talking. And Celine was about my mom, you know, as you know, if you were here last time. And, you know, if she starts talking again, or the sort of narrative voice that is about her starts to speak, I'll certainly write another book. Because I love hanging out with my mom. She died a few years ago, and I really miss her. So it's always fun to hang out with her in the writing of the book.
Someone also mentioned the possibility of a television series. Is that still something that's ongoing?
Yeah. Do you guys know the show Longmire? It's a neat show, and the guy who adapted that and runs the show, Hunt Baldwin, he did a really neat thing a couple months ago. The phone rang, and he said, "This is Hunt Baldwin. I run the show Longmire, and I just spent 7 years doing a TV show about my dad, and now I want to do one about my mom. And I read your book, Celine, and it reminded me of my mom, so I want to make this show." And I was so touched because I said, "Well, you know, it is my mom." And he said, he'd read that, and he began to talk about the points of sort of contact in the book when he first read it that made him want to do it. And it was really neat, you know. It was like two sons talking, and he's going to try and make the show as quick as he can. I hope it works.
When we spoke at lunchtime, I mentioned that I thought the other three books sort of essentially became a canon, and I thought that Celine was a separate book all by itself. And one of the things I thought about it was, the other three books to me seem to be the perfect length. They tell their story and they end. And with Celine, there was just so much backstory that I still wanted to know about. So if I have any influence whatsoever, which I suspect is going to be minimal at best, please write another Celine book.
Thank you. That's neat, huh? Look, the way I write, you know, it's really interesting. I go to the coffee shop and I sit down at the table and I close my eyes and I just think, you know, don't think, just listen. And then it's sort of like, you know, catch as catch can, like who starts talking first? It occurs to me that 100 years ago, I'd probably be locked up for hearing voices. Did I tell you guys a story about the lunatic asylum, the sane asylum? So my uncle was an architect in Vermont, and one of his best friends was an architect in Norway who had been given the commission to change the name of the Oslo, right? The Oslo Insane Asylum. It said, carved in granite over the lintel, it said Insane Asylum, and they wanted to kind of update it and make it a little more PC. So George's friend, he sort of evaluated and he decided the cheapest way and the most efficient way to change the name was to just take the whole block out and flip it around and carve the back. So they took the block out and they flipped it around, and on the back it said Lunatic Asylum.
That's much better. I know you've spoken in the past about your process, which is the first sentence, and from that point on, you just go in whatever direction it sends you. It occurs to me that two books are first person and two books aren't. Do you make a conscious decision beforehand, or does that first sentence just suggest that to you?
The first sentence suggests it, and I have to tell you, when I wrote Celine, so Celine is not first person, it was nerve-wracking because I'd written The Dog Stars and The Painter in first person. The neat thing about first person is you can hide behind your speaker and your character, right? You can never be smarter than your speaker is, or more witty, or more well-read, or anything like that. You know, when you write third person, you're totally exposed. I mean, do you know what I mean by that? And so writing third person, it felt risky to me, but then it was so fun to sort of be able to move the camera, you know, back and put the camera on different people's shoulders. And you could almost get first person in third. You know, if you get close enough to the character describing what they're thinking and what they're doing, it almost seems like first person, but then you can do it again with another character later. And it's very nimble. It's a very nimble way to write, and you can get a lot done. It's not as strongly voiced, I find. And what I love about writing first person, what I love to writing Hig in the Dog Stars, you know, my name is Hig, one name, Big Hig if you need another. If I ever woke up crying in the middle of a dream, and I'm not saying I did, it's because the trout are gone, every one. For me, there's a certain wonder in listening to somebody telling their story and writing it down like that I don't get in third person, that strong voice. So it really is, you know, it's a toss-up. And so, you know, as I write those first lines and discover what the POV is, you know, it's interesting to, you know, make the choice to keep going. Because is that what I really feel like I want to do?
Do the endings to your books really not come to you until very close to that moment?
Absolutely, yeah. I have no idea what the ending is going to be. And you know, I told you guys that story about the guy dying on the first assignment, right? And you may have heard this story before, but the wife took Dave's ashes home, you know, the next day, and we went down to the river the day after, and the river had dropped. It had been rising, you know, and it had dropped down, and it was really sort of lovely, and it had this nice rhythm. And there we were, and we sang Amazing Grace, and I had a book of poetry. My first assignment, I thought I'd bring a book of poetry from the place to sort of capture the heart of the place, and I had a book of Tang Dynasty poetry, and I read one for Dave. And we got in the bus, and we drove around for 2 weeks on the grasslands. And so I got to 27 years later, I finished the Dog Stars. You know, I had been writing in a white heat. You know, Hig had been talking to me, you know, like he was on the other side of a campfire on an October night, you know, with the wind blowing the flames around. He was telling me what happened to him a few years before, and it was so thrilling. And I wrote in a white heat, and I finished the book. And the last page, Hig is lying out under the stars, and he's thinking about his dog, Jasper, and he's making up constellations, and he says, you know, my favorite poem is by Li Shang Yin, and it was written in the 9th century. And it's called, When Will I Be Home? And it was the poem that I read for Dave 27 years before. And it fluttered out of the universe and just kind of landed on the keyboard. And it goes, when will I be home? I don't know. In the mountains, in the rainy night, the autumn lake is flooded. One day, we will be back together again. We will sit in the candlelight by the west window, and I will tell you how I remembered you tonight on this stormy mountain. Oh, the magic of fiction.
Let's spend some more time with Dog Stars. The book begins with very fragmented language. And as someone who spends his days with 8th grade students, I wouldn't get away with that kind of language in front of them because they have to learn much better sentences than that. But I did notice that as the book progressed, the sentences kind of stretched out. Was that intentional?
That's what the French ask. What do you suppose you say? Bien sûr, you know, of course, mais oui. Past the camembert. but it made you know, after I finished the book, I noticed that too. That's really a close read. That's wonderful that you thought about that, because as I read it, I noticed that too with the language. And then it occurred to me, heck, you know, The Dog Stars is about a guy who's telling a story 9 years after a super flu's killed almost everyone. It took his wife, who was pregnant with her unborn child. He lost almost everybody. He lost everybody in his life. He's heavily traumatized. the only guy that he sees every day is a mean gun nut who speaks in one-word sentences. And so Higg, you know, of course, as he starts to, he clears his throat and he starts to tell a story, you know, his language will be broken.
And he's also getting slightly more optimistic as the book progresses.
Right, and that happens as he, good point, but that happens as he makes contact with more people. And as he makes, because he's always looking for human contact, and as he makes human contact, and he gets warmed up telling the story, you know, his sentences stretch out. And to me, I thought, well, that's neat. You know, it makes psychological sense. I didn't mean to do it. But you're a wonderful
reader. So I'm almost as smart as a French person. Yippee.
The English and the French. I mean, this is like the War of the Roses all over again. Oh, my God.
You mentioned Higg's friend. Are you ever concerned that Bangley is just having way too much fun in the post-apocalyptic world?
Well, yeah. I mean, listen, Bangley would have been sorely disappointed if the apocalypse hadn't come, because he'd been waiting for it his whole life. I mean, he has all those guns and, you know. And I don't know if you guys have those folks up here, but in Colorado, I mean...
They do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's having a great time.
At this point, I think we are out of time. And for myself, I thank you for having me as your guest host tonight. It's been super. So thank you.
That was Peter Heller talking with Peter Robertson. Peter Heller's latest novel is The River. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.